Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School. This is DJ Psycho Dandy here with my intrepid co-host, MC Diggy Biscuits. That's going to be our new sign-on.
Yes. DJ Psycho Dandy and MC Diggy Biscuits.
That's you. This will all make more sense as we in the second half of the episode. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
And hello to you, dear listener. Thank you once again for joining us.
Look at you changing it up.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Changing it up.
Turning it up by changing it up.
How's your week been?
It's been good. It's been good. I had a work meeting, my new job this week, and someone came in and we were having like a meeting event type thing, and there was someone that came in and they had this lovely bright shirt that said, "Horror is queer."
Very nice.
And I immediately wanted to be their friend, so I went up to them and I said, "I love your shirt. Tell me what your three favorite queer horror movies are." And then they looked at me and they were like, "Well, all horror is queer." And I was like, I immediately texted Heather and was like, "Heather, the people know.
The people do know.
The people, they do be knowing."
Yeah. I was similarly educating somebody on Twitter about that this week because somebody posted that they, it's like a filmmaker and they're making a film and they're like, "The future of horror is queer." And I'm like, "Here, queer has always been, or horror has always been queer. Queer has also always been horror, but that's a whole other conversation."
Yeah.
as evidenced by continuing attacks against us. But we're going to try to be positive today, right? Stay on the stage.
Trying to be positive, sir.
We're going to gaslight ourselves into positivity so we can survive. But yeah, and I was just like, yeah, like we've always been here, you know? Since
we've already been new.
We already been new, exactly. And so I was kind of, you know, and I was really writing about, because I was like, you know, from Nosferatu till now, you know, because F.W. Murnau obviously was a known homosexual when he made Nosferatu. And I mean, even before that, but it's talking about film at least, you know, it's like, yeah, we've never not been here. We've never not been writing it and shaping it. So watch out.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you having a good week?
Yes, having a very good week.
Good.
It's been...
I know you're in the new job and stuff.
New job. I had an unexpected day off, which was great. I bought some clothes for work. It's so nice to see how Fright School has informed all aesthetics of my life. Because I brought my dear friend Mark to the Big and Tall store, the Big and Tall Emporium here in San Diego, and Mark is an ally. Mark is an ally to the fat, and I was like, "How about this?" And I just pulled a bunch of shirts before he got to the store, and he was like, "They're all black," and I was like, "Well, yeah, because
that's what happens.
That's what happens." And we were like making some cuts because, you know, it's just, I'm not going to buy an entirely new wardrobe. And I was like, "No, this shirt is like, if I was Joshua, this shirt, it needs to be like, figure out what my aesthetic is." So
there we go.
Still figuring that out too.
What's the work wardrobe aesthetic like?
There is no dress code.
Okay.
So literally come as you are. I personally have adopted a dress for your day, type of, like, you know, a personal aesthetic. So like, okay, if I don't have any meetings, or if they're all just at the office, or I'm not going to be seen or perceived by anyone outside of the org, then I'll, you know, I'll wear like shorts or something like that. But outside of the office, it's very, you know, try to keep it professional.
Professional. I love it. That's great.
How was your week?
It's been good. Yeah. You know, just the same as every, you know, I mean, it's always a lot of classwork, a lot of reading, Mm-hmm. Haven't really. Well, we did wrap up The Last of Us. You know, the finale aired.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay. Well, then never mind. So we'll talk about that again soon. we'll break down our thoughts in the future.
Yes.
I did want, before we get too much in, I have been feeling a little sad because it was Creature Feature Weekend.
Yeah.
And so seeing all of our friends over at Horror Movie Night and others like posting about their adventures made me, I missed everybody. I was like, oh, we're not there. Boo.
I know.
Yeah. So just shout out to them. I hope it was fun. I hope you sold lots of products and talk to lots of fun people and just had a great time, and hopefully we'll make it next year or
I know
to some other cons very very soon, because I do want to get out and see folks.
It made me, I was like, oh, I really want to be there. It looked like so much fun.
I felt the same way seeing everybody at Renegade a couple weeks ago, and just all the films that they were showing, and a lot of the films that I loved actually ended up winning awards, and Kay came back and did a presentation of the new director's cut of Black Lake, and that was very exciting. So I'm just hoping that, I'm hoping by next year or at least by later this year even, we could do some more, get out and see, do some fun stuff. So, just to say we definitely missed y'all.
Oh, love that.
And everybody else that's part of, the Geekscape network that was there doing cool stuff. So anyways, yeah. All right, what else? We watched season one of True Detective, because I'm trying to get into they're gonna have a new season coming out with Jodie Foster, which is very exciting. I love to see her back in like a neo-noir criminal something kind of role. So I was rewatching that. That show, it's so strange. It's so twisty. So it's very, very fun to watch. So what else? Yesterday I had some friends over, made dinner, and we didn't do the full thing, but we did like the Hell is a Teenage Girl duo. We watched Jawbreaker and Jennifer's Body.
Aww.
Yeah, so each person had not seen one of the films. So one had seen Jawbreaker, one had seen Jennifer's Body. So it was kind of like cross,
That's nice.
Not that they're exactly related, although again there is some of that that like Heathers, begat, Jawbreaker begat Mean Girls begat. I think Jennifer's Body is the the horror, the super horror version of that.
It's that interlude in the the horror book of Genesis,
there,
right? It's just after the ark is like, and so and so begat so and so, begat so and so.
Yep. So that was really fun. I hadn't watched either of those movies in a really long time, and it was just fun to revisit them and remember some of the quotes and just being, they're such catty, like, fun movies. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of been the week for the most part. What about you? You watch anything exciting? Do anything?
What have I been watching? I really haven't been watching anything other than, like, my usual, like, I've been making my way through episodes of Next Level Chef, and then last week season 20 of Top Chef premiered, so I've been watching that, and I love me some Top Chef. Especially this year, is they're doing something interesting. It's an all-stars season.
Oh, okay.
But it's the 20th season of Top Chef, which in itself is a feat. And they have brought back contestants from that were either winners or finalists of Top Chef seasons from around the world. So there's like Top Chef Italy, Top Chef Thailand, Poland, North Africa, Middle East, all of these different areas, Spain, Brazil, Mexico. So they're trying to, they're all in London, and they're going to see who is the winner of Top Chef All-Stars, International All-Stars season 20.
How cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. Great challenges so far. They had to do, you'll love this, they had to do a challenge where their first elimination challenge was to create a vegetable forward dish where there was a protein that had to be used, but it was just a side dish, like an accompaniment. But it had to be like, you had to use the vegetable and really make it shine.
Highlight, yeah.
And like this guy did, like he just literally made an onion. Like he just like made the best onion that they ever had. Like it was...
like fried it or baked
it? He like
it
grilled it. He cooked it in such a way that like he got it... he cooked it for a long time to get to its sweetness, and then put like a... like a homemade chicken, like a scratch made chicken stock, like emulsion in between the different layers of the onion, and used all these different parts. Like it was a whole thing.
Yum.
Yeah. Very
that sounds
yum.
Good. I mean, I guess depending, because I'm not a huge fan of onion, but I do like once you kind of cook it down and get to like that sweet sureness.
Sure. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. That was actually fun yesterday because I tried a new recipe that I got from Valerie Bertinelli.
Ooh. You know,
Cooking with Valerie or whatever her show's called.
I think it is Cooking with Valerie.
Something like that, or yeah. Valerie's Kitchen, you know, all those kinds of things. But anyways, it was a beef braciole. So it's like you...
Oh, braciole?
Yeah.
Italian?
Yes. Very delicious, where you kind of like... you make the... we got top sirloin steak and you like hammer it, you know, so it's super, super, super thin. And then you put prosciutto on it, and then this like breadcrumb mixture with like parsley and olive oil and, you know, spices and such. And you roll them. So it's these cute little like meat Swiss rolls. And then you like sear those off, and then you cook them in like homemade, you know, you build the sauce from, it's like, I did onion. I don't think Valerie Bertinelli likes onion, so she didn't put onion in hers, but onion, red wine, tomatoes, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you bake it or you cook it in like a Dutch oven for, you know, 2 or 3 hours.
Mm.
It was really good. Yeah, super, super yummy. And Jeffrey made a cauliflower mash to go with it. And I made a caprese salad. Yeah, it was super yum. It was a lovely dinner.
So. Welcome to Fright Culinary School.
I know, right? Yes. that would be the other kind of show I would want to do is like a cooking show.
A podcast
show
about cooking?
Yeah, I don't know what. I do know. My dream would be to do like maybe something like dinner music or something, where it's like you get musicians to come on, talk about their music, like play their songs, and then talk about their favorite dish to prepare.
Ooh.
And they give like the recipe and like talk about it and stuff. That's like, that would be a really cool...
It's like a combination of like Barefoot Contessa meets Live at Daryl's House.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I precisely. I like that a lot.
Yeah. And then sometimes I could like join in, or we could like do a cover together or something. It would be like a fun kind of show. That would be the other kind of podcast that I think would be fun to me.
Would you do like just like any dish they want, or would it be like a specific, like this is a dish that you eat after the tour or at the
no,
end of the night?
Just whatever the best thing they make or the favorite thing that they make, you know, or like, you know, their grandmother's favorite recipe or something.
Sure.
You know, whatever. I don't care. They could just pick a recipe that they like, okay, that they really like, and the history behind it, the story behind it, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure. Okay.
That'd be super fun. I'm sure stuff like that exists, but I have not gone out to seek out to see.
So you're going to, you're going to like watch Stevie Nicks, like make a grilled cheese or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. That'd be awesome. Are you kidding? Yes.
Rihanna. And then you fry the keys. And
yeah.
Stevie Nicks uses Kraft singles and Wonder Bread.
Exactly. That would be the real twist.
Yes.
That would be the real twist. But anyways, back to you. I'm really glad that Top Chef is back, and I hope that you're enjoying it.
I am. I'm enjoying it a lot. They're doing this really interesting thing where it is, they're showing the episodes streaming on Peacock. But so there's a second Top Chef. There's like a side-by-side show where the eliminated chefs can compete to get back on the show, and that's called Last Chance Kitchen. The Last Chance Kitchen episodes are on Hulu, but the original shows are on Peacock, which is interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah. So, but you know, it also made me like look at what else is on Peacock, and I realized, oh fuck, I still need to watch I still need to watch Poker Face.
Oh, yeah. We finished that too.
Here's actually, speaking of things that I finished, I can't believe it is, I finished You, finally.
Oh, okay.
The final season of You, I think season 4, it was released in 2 different parts, one in March and one in February, one in March. And I finished it, and I'm a little muddled with the ending because I was...
Was this a series finale?
It was a series finale.
Oh, so it's okay.
Like, it's over. And, like, I'm a little muddled because, like, it's not as satisfying as I want it to be. It was kind of giving Dexter vibes, the ending of Dexter.
Yeah.
And in a way that, like... I think I wanted it to do more.
Okay.
What I do like and appreciate about the ending, though, is that they're spoilers for You, but the character of Joe, who is, you know, the stalker serial killer, he actually has like more. He is like fully self-aware. Mm. So like the entire series, he's been like living in kind of this denial the entire time of like his true nature, unlike Dexter, which like Dexter is very aware and accepting of Dark Passenger. This guy is like, you know, trying to convince himself that he is not a murderer. He is not a stalker. Mm. And like all his scenes are him murdering and stalking.
Right.
But at the end, there's a self-awareness of like, no, I am this. This is a part of me. And we're just getting started, kind of. So it's pretty interesting and fascinating how that happens.
I wonder if they'll do some like movies or some other offshoots of it or something.
You know, I'm not sure. I know Penn Badgley who plays Joe Goldberg, he has had a complicated relationship with the character. Yeah. Because like his whole thing is like, you shouldn't like him. Like,
yeah, I saw an interview he gave about that.
Yeah. And then he had a very interesting, like, a boundary that was set for this season. Like, he had asked for fewer sex scenes, especially because, like, they did turn the sex all the way up in seasons 2 and 3, because they were also on Netflix. Season 1 was in Lifetime originally canceled, then it moved to Netflix. And, like, seasons 2 and 3 are probably my favorite seasons of the whole thing, but he had asked for there to be no sex scenes or minimal sex scenes, mainly because, you know, he wanted to remain faithful to his wife.
Ah.
Like, it was really interesting and you know, it was a little sweet, a little fascinating how, like, you can get around that, especially because, like, that's part of the character's appeal to a lot of people, is how kind of steamy and intimate it gets. Plus, it's most of the show is narration, so, like, you know, hearing him describe it, like, there's a little bit of an ASMR quality to his voice.
Yeah. I like Dexter's really, yeah, nice that way.
Exactly. It gives a lot of Dexter.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the reasons why I like the show so much.
Yeah.
I loved how they, like, knowing that he asked for that, it was interesting how they kind of worked around it, because, like, they still managed to make it a pretty steamy, sexy show, but, like, they did it, in my opinion, they did it more tastefully and everything. Breakout star of the series, though, Lucas Gage, who got a little with and action. Lucas Gage got a little with and action, which I thought was great for him. But Lucas Gage being, I think his name's Adam in the show. And we may know him from many things, but most recently, season 1 of White Lotus, getting his ass ate. I remember. But anyway.
Yeah, that scene from The White Lotus will forever be in our memories.
It was not groundbreaking, but it was definitely shocking when I saw it. But part of me was also like, that's not really how you...
I know. Yeah, I remember sitting with like a group of people and we were watching it, and I was just like, that's not really, you know... not at least that's not
not as, mechanically.
It's not as accessible as they could be. But whatever, maybe that's.
I was like, sis, you're really like, you know, you're really digging in there.
Right.
It would be like, oh God, here we go. It would be like someone sniffing for truffles in the trunk and not at the base.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It was definitely one of those scenes where you're just like, well, it's not exactly the mechanics, to use your word, of it, but yeah, whatever. It was still one of those things that was like, oh, all right.
We're doing that now.
That's what happened. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you at least got to, you know, watch the end, because, I mean, if it got canceled, it could have never even went to series at all. So, hey, you know, you got a little story to explore over the last few years, and hopefully they, you know, I mean, I'm probably not going to watch that, because I remember hearing what it was about. And I was just like, I'm not interested. I remember we talked about this years ago, I think, on the show even.
I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
If you're not already a fan, then I don't recommend it. It's such very complicated subject matter and very triggering for people who have that experience or who know those things.
But if people are unhappy with the way it ends, or you know, or if it's muddled like you said, then maybe maybe they'll make a film, or maybe they'll do another, you know, special set of episodes or something. Who knows? But
yeah,
whatever. Alrighty, well, DJ Diggy Biscuits,
yes.
I guess we'll take a quick break and we'll be back to take it all the way back to 1944 with Gaslight.
Hi, friends. The world got you down. Don't be sad. Listen to $2 Late Fee with Zach and Dustin.
$2 Late Fee is the podcast that celebrates the best decade of entertainment, the 1980s. We pick a movie and soundtrack from our youth that we loved and see if it holds up today. We also interview your favorite celebrities from that era.
All in the spirit of positivity and togetherness. Check us out at $2LateFee.com.
Gaslighting!
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 Shit's getting real!
Shit's getting real!
Welcome back. Yes, we are finally. I don't know how we haven't done this movie in all this time, you know, especially when we did that whole like dive into like feminism, you know, where we did the we did a whole like year, it felt like, of
we did do a year that was like our like second season
semester of,
our
whole school year devoted to feminist films, and somehow we never did Gaslight. Now it's not necessarily like horror like that happens on the show, but it's a psychological thriller, so it is under the umbrella
it's gothic
of the horror genre. Yes, it's very gothic, it's noir, film noir. Very fun example of that. But yeah, so 1944, directed by George Cukor, Cukor, C-U-K-O-R. I'm not exactly sure how you say it, but Cukor? Cocker. No, kidding. That was just his side gig.
Yes. He's George Cuck.
Yes.
He's a little cucker.
He was
a known
homosexual. Well, it was like an open secret. But his place for a while in the, like, the 40s, 50s, 60s was like the place for the homosexuals to hang out. So he was known.
Cary Grant. Yes. Rock Hudson.
Like all those guys and their, you know, golf caddies. Their traveling companions.
Their traveling
could all be comfortable in style. You know, and to talk about golf caddying and companioning. Of course. Nothing else. No other things were happening.
My gardener.
And we got Charles. Is it Boyer? Is that how that's said? Or is it Boyer? B-O-Y-E-R.
Maybe let's not complicate it.
Charles,
I don't know.
Anyways.
French over here wants to like make everything an accent.
Right. The more important thing person is Ingrid Bergman.
Yes.
Sorry, I called her a thing because, as we know at this time, women were property. Excuse me. No, I meant person. Ingrid Bergman, Joseph Cotten, and Miss Angela Lansbury just serving all kinds of sassiness. And cocknery.
Yes, she's serving all the cocknery.
She really is. It's like you watch this movie. It's like, yeah, she definitely kind of steals some of the scenes she's in with her with her her face.
Yes.
Her whole face just making all kinds of expressions. It's from a play by Patrick Hamilton, who also famously wrote Rope. Play that Hitchcock. So he had two at this roughly around the same time. Because when did Rope, the film, come out? That was, we did a whole episode on, I can't remember, 1948. So just a few years later, two very, you know, popular and famous and well regarded horror psychological thriller films based on plays by him. Gaslight, his original play, was actually written in 1938. And it goes, it's called something else. Oh, Angel Street. They changed the name to like avoid confusion or something with like the films, because this actual film that we watched, Gaslight, the 44 film, is based on, is a remake of a British film from 1940.
Oh, okay.
And so the studio, MGM, actually tried to, they said they would make it, invest all this money in it, as long as the original film, all of its negatives, any copy of it, was destroyed. But it survived. That didn't happen. But that was the thing, that they were going to do that. And it varies a bit from the play and the original movie, from what I understand. But I've not seen the 1940 version. I did try to find it. So I don't know. Maybe at some point we'll watch that too and see. We compare it. We can compare and contrast it.
We need to summon up the film freaks to figure out if it's trapped somewhere.
Right. Exactly. Well, no. Actually, you can find it on Amazon.
Oh, interesting. Oh,
nice. Yeah. I just meant that I've never watched it before. I don't know. Anyways, sorry.
Was it also called Angel Street?
No, it's called Gaslight.
Okay.
But I think the original play, it's two words, Gaslight.
Oh, I see.
And then they made the film Gaslight, and then this version. So it was just made on a bigger scale. It had a bigger budget, and it just has some... You just stuff in it that's, you know, the benefit of having a giant studio behind you.
Sure.
And as most of us know, these days, cause I think gaslight or gaslighting was like the 2022 Webster Merriam Dictionary word of the year. So most of us have now become familiar with the term, but it's, famously, it's called denominalized. We denominalization of the title into a verb. So it's been verbed, like getting Dixie chicked. You know, when you say something political and get in trouble for it. And then they famously made an album called Gaslighter with the song called Gaslighter.
Yeah.
So see how it all just comes back around? All about gaslighting.
Look at you connecting all those dots.
Right.
Look at you sitting in the waiting room with the children.
Yeah, Charlie Kelly smoking a cigarette with 10,000 things glued to the wall and red string. that's constantly what's going on in my mind. In fact, the other day we were listening to Morrissey's song Suede Head, and I was like, wow, this sounds like it's like the lyrics from it sound like a Joan Armatrading song, The Weakness in Me. Guess what? I look it up. It was. He was inspired by that song. Who knew? But that's how my brain works. I'm like, there's got to be a connection here. Anyways, I didn't need to say all that.
No. Why are you bringing Morrissey into this?
I know.
That racist.
Right. Yeah. Fuck him. Except that he does hate the monarchy, and we do love that about him. But otherwise, yeah, we don't.
He hates the monarchy and black people.
Yeah, he's gross. we're going to have to like cut this whole section out. Anyways, back to the point. Gaslight. It is a film about a husband who is trying to drive his wife insane so that he can basically rob her blind. That's what this is. That's what this movie is about. Joe, what did you think of old Gaslight?
I loved it.
Yeah, it was fun.
I loved it. That poof that wrote this, man, like he understood the assignment. I mean, because I loved Rope as well.
I don't know if Patrick Hamilton was queer. That I don't know.
I said what I said.
Okay. All right. I just want to say that's unconfirmed. I don't know. I know he was an alcoholic. I found that out. And he had a rather sad life. And he was kind of an angry, misanthropic person.
You're not doing anything to be like, he's not a big ol' one. So, I loved it. I loved it a lot. It totally makes sense now. Why? Because if you said this is the same guy who did Rope, like, I loved Rope as well. And I think this is like, this is one of those movies that you're going to put on in the background. I would watch this again, but in that context where it's just like, you know, it's a background movie. it really, I think what I love the most about it was that it really does like give you the textbook definition of gaslighting the yes. entire fucking time.
That's, yeah.
It would be true. Like, you know, it would be like if you had a movie called, if you had a movie called Munchausen's by Proxy, and it was just that the
right.
entire time. It was beautiful. I loved every minute of it. Ingrid Bergman was fantastic.
Yeah.
I did not know this until you mentioned it, but Ingrid Bergman is the mother of Isabella Rossellini, who is one of my favorite people in the world. And it shows because she looks exactly like her.
Yeah. Yeah. They share a lot of features.
Yeah. The eyes and like just the face in general. My dear, it was very good. I'm so happy that I got to watch it. I mean, you saw me. Like, I barely had my phone in my hand.
I know. I would look over and you were actually, like, watching.
My attention was rapt. I was like, oh, my God, this poor man is gaslighting this woman with literal gaslights. Because so I'm like, also that's part of like why I was like rapt, because I was like, I don't want to blink and miss where the gaslights come into play,
right?
Because that was like a whole part of like, that's a whole plot point, is that, you know, she Paula is like, you know, the gaslights are going dim, that means that someone else is using them, but like no one's
right, but who?
But who?
Yeah.
But who?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things to know about the film, is because I think sometimes people think that the husband is like purposely messing with the lights, and that's where the word comes from, but it's not. Like, it's just, it's a byproduct of his other behaviors, because at this time, it's set in 1875.
Well,
1975, when we had
the murder light. Happens in 1875 or 4, right? And then it's 10 years after that. So, okay. Like, 18. I mean, yeah, it's still Victorian era.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. It is 1875. So, yeah, it does have to be about 10 years. So, whatever. It's still, it's in that.
Yeah, it's in the Victorian
before era. Before 1900 time period where, you know, so they were piping in gas to run the lights. But if you turn on lights in another part of the house, it may pull, you know, the... Mm-hmm. The resource to another, so the lights would dim, and then she would hear somebody like walking around the attic and such. So that's kind of the gaslighting aspect of it. It's not that that isn't actually something in the film that he is weaponizing against her.
No,
because he doesn't even really need to, because he's constantly telling her she's crazy and constantly telling her that she's.
It's so interesting because like he's doing this whole thing where it's just like, you know, oh, like is there something? Is someone using the lights in another part? Is the cook Elizabeth, right? Is the cook doing making something? And he's like, no, everything's fine. What's going on? It's fine in here. It's not dark at all.
That is true. Yeah. He does act like but it's not exactly that he's messing with the lights in order to drive her crazy. It's all part of it.
Yeah. Hey, Joshua, I have a joke for you. Are you ready? Have you heard the one about have you heard the joke about gaslighting?
Don't try it.
Come on, humor me. Have you heard the joke about gaslighting?
No, I haven't.
Yes, you have. Don't do this.
Oh, Joe, you're fired.
I gotta derail you sometimes. Keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, that was delightful. I really appreciate that.
All right.
I bet it took you just so much time to write that joke and to really work on that.
I did, and I just saw it as a it was a meme.
You're stupid. All right. Well, so let's get down to overcomplicating gaslight, as we like to do on this show.
Yeah.
So what I actually think is kind of cool about watching this is obviously the play was written in 1938. We get a film in 1940. We get another film in 1944. So we're in that time after World War One, before, you know, World War Two really gets going, you know, or at least the United States involvement in with Hitler and all of that. It was a really interesting time for women. So not only is the time frame that it's working in an interesting time for women when the film comes out, but the time in that it's set in sure. this like period between 1860 to like 1920 is sort of where we started to see this. We really started like socially constructing like illness for women in a way. Mm-hmm. So there's this great, I guess it's like a pamphlet, I guess is what they call it. It's like 24 pages. It's called Complaints and Disorders, the Sexual Politics of Sickness.
Ooh,
by,
interesting.
Barbara Ehrenreich and Deidre English. And it talks about the ways that like sickness, illness, health, wellness are socially constructed and applied to women in different ways. And so there's this idea that, you know, women are contextualized as inferior in relation to, you know, the normative superior or male. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then this fact, quote, is, you know, used to benefit the patriarchy, capitalism, other parties with power. And it's convenient to utilize it, but it's often contradictory and like dissonant. So women can be both too biologically weak to work and engage in the public if they are rich at this time, while also thought of as biologically sturdier and requiring hard work to have value if they are poor or of color. So women were kind of living in this really weird space where they kind of had to invent reasons, because after women got the right to vote, it's like men had to come up with ways to like keep them from actually doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, oh, you're far too weak to be educated for because you're so inferior as mm-hmm. a sex. So you just need to, as rich women, like they prescribe them like lives of leisure. You know, you just need to sit around in your withdrawing room, as we learned today. You need to sit there. You need to sleep. You need to, like, you know, be very you know, kept in this sort
you
of
You need
cage.
To, like, ring the bell to have the maid put coal on the fire, even though you're standing 2 feet from it.
Exactly. You know, so what's happening to her happened to a lot of women at that time, you know, especially women who had access to power in some ways. You know, she's wealthy. She's inherited a lot of money. She's inherited property. Mm-hmm.
All her wealth. All the wealth in between the two of them is from her.
It's her from her aunt who's been murdered, and so. So society kind of like got together to like concoct ways, you know, men, the patriarchy, to kind of create ways to keep rich women like out of public, out of educational spaces, out of political spaces, especially in the aftermath of like, you know, the women's suffrage movement that was coming. Sure. I realize I said the right to vote that wouldn't come till 1920, but the movement before that was very strong and very powerful.
And there was also, I mean, the women's suffrage, this takes place in England, right? So the women's suffrage movement was a little ahead at that point.
Yeah, yeah. That's also true. But I'm thinking about, you know, this being an American-made film and released in America, kind of what it was speaking to at the time.
Yes.
But anyways, the point is that in this time before, after you had like the first main, you know, women's movement that had sort of happened here and abroad, mm-hmm. you know, we just start to see these ways that we have to keep, it's like making upper class women sick. So mm-hmm. they would create infirmaries, like these physicians, they would say that women were naturally nervous, anxious, frail, weak, and they prescribed them isolation, enforced leisure, and quite bluntly, ignorance. Like mm-hmm. we cannot allow you to be educated because you're far too weak for that, and it will it will kill you if you know too much. And so after you had kind of this big rise from women, it allowed the immediate like forcing them out of political education and like public spaces.
Sure.
And then, of course, this disengaged them from helping and being like sympathetic to the needs of feminist causes, but that divided, you know, poor and rich women, and it just mm-hmm. continued to like grow those major like class divides. And then, of course, all the other reasons, like, you know, we had to create more and more illnesses because it wasn't profitable to really treat poor people.
Yeah.
So we wanted to be able to charge, you know, these rich women and of course their husbands all this money to like do billing. So this is kind of like a little bit of a history of that I studied in part of it was studying in women in history, but also gender and technology mm-hmm. Course that I took. So some of this is kind of, I'm pulling from that, the research of that. And of course on the other side, I do like this, which kind of happens. This happens in the movie towards the end. So The subversion of this situation by rich women is really kind of fascinating, kind of cool. So although women didn't have a lot of power in like the public spaces, they kind of weaponized this like institutional gaslighting of them against men in some ways. So like, for instance, you know, they could avoid unwanted sex. So while men were exerting quite a bit of power over their reproduction, this allowed women a bodily autonomy in some ways, because they could just be too, I'm just too sick, I'm just too weak, I'm just too this or that. And then they would also use their illness as an excuse to let out their rage. So there was this idea that, like, you know, rich women were like prone to hysterical outbursts, and it was just them just letting off steam because they could. Because if they're just so sick and emotional, it's like, I might as well just scream and rave and act completely insane.
Which is what happens in the movie.
Right, exactly. And so at the end, it like kind of, she turns it around on him like, oh, I'm so sick, I'm so crazy, right? Like, this isn't a knife in my hand, is it? Where did it go? You know, I just love that whole sequence, because that is something that historically we did see some women do that in order just to have some control over their circumstances of being prisoners.
Have you heard of the Sarah Rule play In the Next Room or the Vibrator play?
Yeah, I've definitely heard that term, but go ahead, educate.
So the Sarah, it's 2009.
Elucidate.
It's a 2009 play by Sarah Rule called In the Next Room or the Vibrator play. That's essentially about, like, it takes place in like Victorian times where an electrical scientist creates a device to help women with their hysteria.
Right.
And their hysteria is basically inadvertently creating a vibrator. So basically, you know, the cure for their hysteria is giving them orgasms.
Yeah.
Which is essentially what you're talking about as well. Like, it's...
Yeah, to some degree.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of that kind of comes out of this time, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, wellness... orgasms.
The cure for wellness.
The cure for wellness.
Orgasms,
is,
yes.
Yeah.
yeah. So I just kind of wanted to bring that up because this is very like historically interesting to kind of think about this film being set in the time it was and the way the medicalization of women was happening. And of course, on the other side, like I said earlier, you know, we had this eugenics movement here, and that the poor were biologically inferior. It had nothing to do with social context. This was something that we believed. And we also thought that those women needed to work hard, you know, for their own good. So it's like, okay, are women biologically weak and inferior, or are they so sturdy and strong they need to be working at all times and they need to be in factories? You know, poor women needed to be in factories, which kind of gets back then, just to move this up a little bit into the other point I wanted to make about the particular time that this comes out. So, you know, men went off and done World War One. Men and, I mean, there were women involved in war efforts, but generally speaking, at home, women had to go out and work, obviously, because, you know, a lot of men went off to fight in, you know, various wars. So then when those men returned, it was sort of like having to gaslight women into thinking that they weren't actually as like skilled at labor and as smart and all of these things as they thought they were. So we were kind of going through this whole thing, and this happened again after World War II ended. And this is sort of what Betty Friedan writes about in The Feminine Mystique, how women went and they got educations, and then they became mothers and they just stayed at home, being sort of like tricked by society into like thinking that this was good enough. And for some women, it certainly was. But there were plenty of women that were like unhappy with being forced back out of, you know, feeling like they were contributing to society in very, very meaningful ways. And so when you go to see this movie in 1944, I feel like it had to have really resonated in some way about being like, because she does seem like a capable woman who wants to like live a life, and her husband is just like, you're sick and you're, you know, you need to stay home and take care of me and take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And so there is this really interesting sort of, I think, cultural context for this. And then again, the other side is thinking about sort of what Hitler was doing at this time and politics at the time of mm-hmm. like gaslighting and you know, saying, no, this isn't what we're doing. We have no intention of committing mass murder, even though they had clearly been saying that for a while and they clearly yep. built camps and, you know, other systematic means to commit mm-hmm. genocide while on the world stage behaving as it's like, what are you talking about? That's not happening. Yep. Don't look behind me. That you did not see what you thought you saw.
No. Get it? You did not see.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, I didn't mean to say that. That's terrible. But it's that exact thing. It's like, you know, the people start saying, no, we have seen these camps. We have seen this happen. It's like, no, you didn't. I was trying to find, I had found a really interesting quote that kind of talked about that. Because it was sort of also, it was contextualizing like the mm-hmm. Trump era politics, you know, mm-hmm. like when we think mm-hmm. about 2016.
It's not a travel ban.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And all the other things, you know, gosh darn it. Where was that? It was such a good comparison about, yeah. Oh, Hitler's idea was never to make the people doubt their own sanity, but reinforce their trust that the state couldn't possibly be unreasonable. This was through the big lie. In the big lie, there's always a certain force of credibility. It would never come into the broad masses of the nation's heads to fabricate colossal untruths. And then they would not believe that others could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously. So basically, we'd be crazy to think the person stating truth would be crazy enough to make such a crazy claim. If it weren't indeed the truth, like, isn't that a bit of a like? But I feel like this is the same thing. Like when you listen to like Trump talk, it's uh-huh. like, this is insane. But some people are hearing him like perfectly clear, like as if he's like the most brilliant mind. They're like, no, he's just saying it like it is. It's like you can't see the ways you're being like manipulated and like you're being gaslighted.
Yeah.
Let's see. I know there was something else because that was a big thing because like Jewish people at the time were like, y'all. This is real, and we need to, like, take yeah. this seriously. Like, they were fleeing as early as 1922, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
1922, they were fleeing to the Balkans from Germany and, like, warning American papers that were, like, talking about Hitler before, you know, he became what he became, but when he was just sort of the, you know, the leader of this sort of rising political movement, they were afraid enough to run and flee, but that wasn't enough for like people to believe that something really bad was on its way.
Sure.
Which is just, again, really, really fascinating. Like you're being told, like this isn't. But again, when we found out what it was just the unimaginable magnitude of the Holocaust. It was hard to believe. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it makes sense. Like, you know, imagine being there in the 40s and like, never having access to information like we did before, like yeah. World War II really brought that, kind of changed the way news and the war, you know, all of yeah. that, the way that we communicate about these things.
Yeah. It's also the birth of like the modern. It's the birth of communication studies because communication studies right. comes out of propaganda studies
yep.
Or study of propaganda,
yeah.
and that is like one of the ways in which that Hitler was able to be as influential as he was because he was a very dynamic and persuasive speaker. He yeah. used film, he used radio, he used the mass media. And in fact, those Jews, those thinkers who fled, who were one of the first people to flee, they are the first huge critics of like any sort of mass communication, mass media, even for movies, the yeah. way for, you know, saying that mass communication is a way for people to disengage and not be as engaged in reality. They said this about movies. I think I'm thinking of like the Frankfurt School, Horkheimer, Adorno, you know, fun is a medicinal bath type of thing. So,
right.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
Yeah. No, that is a great point. So it just kind of really further contextualized this film where, you know, it was a big hit. It was nominated for 7 Oscars, mm-hmm. won a couple. It's very well regarded. Just in 2019 was added to the American, whatever the national film, what is it they call the Library of Congress?
The National Film Registry.
Yeah.
In 2019?
Yeah.
That seems really late.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it's because of the growing influence that it had. 2019, selected for preservation by the National Film Registry, being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. And you think about the term itself becoming this big thing in 2016. Now, it's been used before. It's been, I think I found, like, even in the, like, the 70s it was used, and, you know, possibly even before that. But mm-hmm. in American television, even, it was used on in a 1970s show. I can't remember what it was. So it's not as if it was a brand new term, but it really kind of took on new meaning in the Trump era. Mm-hmm. And we saw lots more discussion of it and lots more use of it. And like I said, you know, we get a big song by the Chicks in Gaslighter. It's like super fascinating, the whole kind of thing. And it really does come down to just typical like narcissistic manipulation. you know? I mean, like gaslighting is an easy term to talk about instead of like getting into like the psychological manipulative, emotional abuse, mm-hmm. Psychological abuse that gaslighting is. It's just a nice, easy, quick term to know what we mean when we say that. Especially when you talk to people who are being abused, they know this term now. So it's a nice shorthand. Yeah. But and it's not a new phenomenon, obviously.
And isn't language fascinating, right? Like, this is like one of the first, this is like a term that is that has come to prominence and to in popular use, but it's like directly influenced by a movie, by a film, you know? It's, in that way, it's just like, it's interesting about language.
So something else, just to get us out of the historical stuff. And again, there's so much more. I mean, there's a lot of great articles written about this time and how this film is like contextualized, especially again, we have the benefit of hindsight. And so to be able to look back and be like, what a crazy thing for this movie to come out at this particular time in history.
Yeah.
It really just highlights the overall like feeling that both women had, but then as a world, as a global experience of like what was happening at this time. It's just super fascinating. Something else that I wanted to talk about that I just thought was kind of fun. This is from, Senses of Cinema. .com mm-hmm. had an article written, "The Madman in the Attic, Gaslight and the Psycho Dandy." So it's sort of this analysis of the character in the film, played by what was his name? Oh, that's Charles. So Gregory mm-hmm. Anton, but who's actually Sergius Bauer, mm-hmm. the villain of the story. And kind of talking about how, he's this character of who's like, you know, well-dressed and, just a dandy. We know what a dandy mm-hmm. is, but, you know, he's the villain. He's evil. But what I kind of liked about the discussion of him is that he's not like your typical like homosexual villain. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think he's not contextualized as queer necessarily, like as mm-hmm. at least as a man interested in men, mm-hmm. But because he has a wife, he has kids in another place. I think he seems to have a sexual interest in Angela Lansbury's character. You know, they kind of flirt and stuff with each other. But what I thought was interesting about this analysis of him is like, he's not really interested in anybody. He's actually possibly suffering from like objectophilia. So it's this idea that he's in love with objects, like when he's talking about like the jewels, how like beautiful they are. And he like humanizes the jewels, mm-hmm. and he's like in this like search for them. So it's like he's very materialistic. And I just thought that was kind of a fun twist, because usually at this time, you know, when you get that kind of dandy type character, it's like, oh, well, he's gay, he hates women, so of course he's like, that's where that sort of comes from, is like that we, you know, like we're queer because we just hate women so much that we can't bear to like be with them, so we have to murder them or gaslight them in this, or
sure.
or commit other acts of violence or aggression towards them. And so he's not exactly that sort of character. He kind of reminds me again. I add him not exactly Rope. I do say Rope is also a psycho dandy kind of trope, but that's more on a, you know, more on the queer. But like I think of American Psycho, Patrick Bateman, you know, Christian Bale's character in that. He's very, very, you know, well dressed and like takes care of himself. There are whole sequences of him like doing his facial care and exercising, take care of himself. He's very dedicated to his own beauty. While also committing these, like, you know, horrific serial killing acts.
Dandy and American.
Dandy Mott.
Yeah.
He was my next, right?
Yes.
Dandy Mott. Who also doesn't strike me as queer. I mean, he's, you know, he, I do think he liked the girls, the twins, so to speak. I think that it is a particular kind of, like, heterosexual-ish character.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I was curious what you thought about it. Have you ever heard that term before, psycho dandy? Because we've talked about psycho biddies before.
Yes.
But psycho dandy, I'd never really heard that before. And
I've heard of dandy, but only in like a queer, you know, theory.
Usually
type of,
it is. Usually it's like stressed in that, in more of that way.
Which like I also see like when you have like, it makes sense. It makes sense to me when it's in that context of like the misogyny. And I love how you just like, you know, laid that out of like, you know, oh, like, you know, we hate women so much that we must kill them because we do not want to be with them. We do not want to sleep with them.
That's like the that's like the idealization. That's the horror of it. That's why, you know, you see us in that kind of position sometimes. I think that there's part of it is informed by that.
Could it also be, and this is just me spitballing, right? Like, could it also be that, like, we are also jealous of them because they get to be with men in a way that we don't?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that's part of, what is the movie? There's a movie like that. Well, we see that in, like, Rebecca.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
The maid.
Yeah, with the maid. So we see that too with I guess it's probably, I shouldn't just like contextualize it with like queer men because queer women kind of get pulled in this too. There was something I was recently watching actually about, what was it? I don't know, but it kind of had something similar where I was like, wait a second, is this going to be some like evil lesbian character who's like, you know, trying to kill everybody? What the hell was it?
And was it?
No, I think it turned out to be something else. But
Tom Holland's character, season two.
Oh,
of,
you know what? I actually think it was. We were talking. I think it was with The White Lotus, season two.
Tom Hollander's character?
No, the woman. The front desk.
Oh, the Valentina.
Hotel. Yeah, Valentina. I think it was her that I was thinking. Like, not that she was going to be a murderer, but I'm like, are they like trying to villainize her with? Because she was kind of creepy with that girl.
Yeah.
You know, in a weird way, like buying her things and doing stuff. And I was like, where is this going, and what are they trying to send a message to us about? Because you're also right, Tom Hollander's character. Yeah. I made that mistake too because I call him Tom Holland, and people are like, that's not who that is. I'm like, whatever. Yeah. Tom Hollander. Yeah, exactly. Like they, yeah, these like evil homosexuals, these evil gays are out to get her.
These gays are trying to murder me, Mika Piche. Come on.
Although actually really quick, do you think they actually were
gay?
Like trying to kill her.
Oh, well, spoilers for White Lotus.
We could talk about it off, but I was kind of watching it. I'm like, I still feel like, do we really know what was happening?
I think that that's intentional.
Yeah.
I think they set the table so much.
I know.
That like, it's hard to not think about it that way, especially like the one guy who, I think this is the one guy who got away, but like he was just like crying.
Right.
At that, but like, I was also watching it.
Well,
and
they
like,
do knock down the door into the room. So if they were really not trying to hurt her, then they probably wouldn't have broken the door. So I guess, yeah, it does make sense that they were. I just wish that we had more confirmed details about what was going on. But I did feel it was a little bit regressive in a way. But I also was thinking, have we gotten so meta and so far into the future that we can have evil gays again? Like, you know, like it's okay to like demonize the homosexual.
true. I just think it's really, I just thought it was just like, interesting how like her entire life, right? Her entire life, she has been, she's been both the person pulling the strings, as we see with Belinda, the spa manager in season one, and then we see it, and then in season two, like, you know, she's having the strings pulled on her by her husband, by these gays,
right?
And then she takes control of the situation. starts killing everybody, only to die the like in the worst way, undignified and by accident. And completely by accident.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, the whole thing. But anyways, back to this. I was just like thinking about the ways that queer people are usually contextualized as villains, especially in these time periods, because it's like, okay, well, you can have a gay person on screen, but they have to be a bad person, or they have to suffer some kind of, you know, morality.
And like, it makes sense that it was like going in that direction, right? Because of everything that happens with Jack and Portia. Like, Jack is completely terrified, like, drops Portia off at the airport.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, just says, go away. Which, like, girl, don't, like, you're going to get on a plane and your fucking boss is dead. Like, you're suspect number one at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
So, yeah, just to kind of pull it back to Gaslight. So, yeah, I just like that it's like the husband is a man whose primary erotic response is not to women or even to other men, but to jewels, to priceless, coldly exquisite objet d'art. Mm-hmm. It's this archetype of the psycho dandy, an immaculately groomed gentleman of refined taste and non-existent morals who would turn without scruple to murder to possess the objects of his desire. And then it kind of goes on to talk about some other examples, which again compares like each of these men is implicitly gay or at least asexual. They don't want to have sex with these women. It's about the, the possession of whatever. I'm just seeing if there were any other points about this that I thought was interesting. It is kind of cool that they get Bergman to play this role because, she's somebody who had made all of these really, these other types of films. She was kind of thought of as a strong woman. Mm-hmm. So kind of subverting that in this film is really interesting.
But like it completely redeems it at the end, and that's the other thing too, that's the insidiousness of like the gaslighting in the film, is that like he took this woman who was beautiful, strong, happy, beyond happy in the beginning, as happy as you can be still recovering from the trauma of finding your aunt murdered, and then like, you know, taking her, twisting her, driving her to the edge of madness, and then at the very end she reclaims that.
Yeah, exactly. There was one more point that I thought was kind of cool. So Kukor, I really wish I would have figured out how to say his name. That's so bad. I always criticize others when they do that. So look at me. I'm the problem. It's me. A discreet but openly gay director in a homophobic Hollywood system reinvented the camp and asexual archetype of the psycho dandy as a potent heterosexual love god. At the end of Gaslight, when Boyer is caught and led away by the force of justice, his villainy exposed and plain for all to see, at least half of the women in the audience, and most likely some of the men, would gladly accept his offer of a date. So I think it's kind of cool of like twisting, you know, you have a queer director twisting a famously an archetype used to demean and villainize queer men into this sort of way. I think it's kind of cool. Other stray observations before we wrap up. I am definitely Mrs. Thwaites.
Yes.
That's my character. I'm here for her all the way. She's like an early true crime enthusiast with her Diggy Biscuits. I love her. I'm here for her.
I know.
She's
so I was great. Like her
bursting into people's houses, asking questions, being nosy.
Makes you wonder if, like, you know, a young Angela Lansbury was inspired by her,
right?
Jessica Fletcher.
Yeah, it's like, who was that woman I was in that movie with?
Yeah, she's just like all like literally like storming her way into the house to like see where the people are being murdered, and it's like, oh, he's got, you know, it's like six wives. I'm like, she's one of the, like, oh, you're a true crime podcaster now.
Yes, she absolutely would be.
We need to talk about my remake.
Oh, right. Yes. You want to make your, you want to do your remake.
Yes, we're going to do a remake. All right, everybody, here's the pitch right now. So if this happens, copyright, I'm owed money. Okay,
copyright,
so
Joe.
Here we go. We're going to remake
Diggy
Gaslight. We're going to remake.
Which are the food that Mrs. Thwaites makes,
yes,
by the way.
digestive biscuits.
Right.
So we are going to remake Gaslight, and we're going to do it with Jordan Peele directing.
Okay.
It's going to have Audra McDonald as the aunt.
Okay.
As Aunt Alice.
So we're going to get a little more extended sequence with her then.
A little
she's
bit.
She's got to sing something.
We're going to have her sing a little bit. Okay. I like the idea of putting her, making her be like an opera singer or some sort of diva-ish type person.
Yeah.
So she, you know, she'll be there. We'll have Kiki Palmer as Paula.
Okay.
I'm thinking maybe a little Sterling K. Brown as Sergius, a.k.a. Whatever his name was. What was his name? Sergius. George.
George.
Yeah. We'll do maybe Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the detective. And the thing about it is that it will all take place around, like, you know, the hip-hop, the Atlanta hip-hop scene.
Oh, okay.
And
wow,
so
you're really updating it.
We're updating it all
Did
the way.
Did you say who the Angela Lansbury character is?
Yes. Angela Lansbury will be... we're thinking either Megan Thee Stallion or Cardi B will
Cardi
be Angela Lansbury.
That's my favorite.
She's like, they gaslighting up in here. And now thinking about like Miss Thwaites, I would love her to be Octavia Spencer, but like listening to like a true crime podcast.
Yeah. Look at you.
Yeah.
Why don't people take your suggestions for?
I don't know.
For
I
films?
Don't know.
And then you said Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the police officer.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the police officer.
Right. Interesting.
Falling in love with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Kiki Palmer. I'm not married to Kiki Palmer. I think it would be fun. So like, you know, I'm
I just think
open
after her playing
anything.
All of these other kind of strong, it would be interesting to see her in that kind of role.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm not really invested in this. This is like your thing. This is
well. Could we
Joe's.
Also do it? Could it also be like we don't have to do like the black version? We could do also a queer version as well, and make it a little bit more horrific. So you know, we could do where like you know a man is gaslighting you know his lover, his like younger twink lover, and you know to thinking, and still have Audra McDonald.
Yeah, and we can get Bryan Singer to play that role.
And I oop.
All right. Well, on that note, we have talked long enough. That was Gaslight 1944. Obviously, it's informed. I feel like a lot of horror, especially like women's horror, like when we have these kinds of conversations.
A lot of real life horror.
Yeah. And again, when we think of like, you know, I mean, there's so many movies. Rosemary's Baby, for instance. We talked a little bit about this when we talked about Gothica. You know, just this idea of like the presence of gaslighting and these behaviors have long... been an important part of horror.
Yeah.
So we salute you, Gaslight 1944. Thank you for your service. With that, thank you to all of our Patreon members. We so appreciate you and, you know, all of the support you give us. You, dear listener, for listening to this.
And if you're not a Patreon subscriber, please consider being a Patreon subscriber. You have access to videos of... videos of our conversations, a few of our conversations when we record remotely. sometimes we'd like it the old way, you know,
we don't
record the old way. You can also join us on the After Fright School special where you can look you can consume Joshua's disgust for movies like Bros and
shows like Heartstopper.
I don't know, maybe Josh
is tortured. I'm being gaslighted by Joe.
Yes, it's like why do you think this is a good movie? Like this is not a good movie. She's especially of like My Best Friend's Wedding, she's terrible, she's the villain.
Yes, but time has sided with me on that one.
Yes, so time has sided with you. We have now revealed Julia Roberts to be the villain in that one. So please consider supporting us at any level possible for Patreon. And don't forget also, we are proudly a part of the Geekscape Network.
Yes,
we have there's plenty of great content there. So check out our lovely partners, our siblings, brothers, sisters, siblings. At Geekscape.
Yes, I love it. All right, thank you, and good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.